Welcome back. Joining us now after a long hiatus, at least from our show, is Bob Murphy, economist Bob Murphy. Bob, how you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Y'all have probably heard Bob at least every other week on the Tom Woods Show, which airs on this network at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Bob is going to be teaching a class, I guess, at Mises here in Auburn, Alabama, Introduction to the Free Markets. Is that right, Bob?
Right, yeah. It starts this Thursday. It's a six-week online class. It's very affordable. I think it's like $59, something like that. And, yeah, we're just going to go through the middle section of my textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist, which just walks through the basics of how a market economy works. We'll talk about where prices come from, where money comes from, what the stock market is, things like that. So it's good for homeschoolers, but also even older people who just never got a satisfactory introduction to market economics. I think this class could be for them.
All right. Now, suppose somebody wanted to sign up for this class. How do they go about doing that?
They would go to the website academy.mises.org. And Mises is M-I-S-E-S.
All right. Now, what are we? Can you give me a little bit of a syllabus? What are we going to be discussing? Like, it starts Thursday of this week. What are we going to be discussing Thursday?
Thursday, we're going to talk about the origin of money, and so just to explain like the limitations of barter exchange and where money came from historically. So the answer is it wasn't that some wise king just decided one day, hey, everybody, let's start using this shell as money. That actually media of exchange and then those developed into money emerged from just normal market operations. And so we'll just walk through that. And the Austrian economists, Karl Menger in particular, really had a lot to say about the origin of money. And then Ludwig von Mises sort of reconciled it with modern pricing theory. And so because it's being hosted by the Mises Institute, I'll give a little background on that just so people can understand the contributions that the Austrian economists made to this portion of economic thought.
Now we're going to get into the old tally sticks and the Roman denarii and the whole gambit?
I mean, we might touch upon that a little bit, but it's more I'm going to focus just on the principles of it so the students can understand what it is that money actually does, and then where did it, how could it have arisen just through normal trading operations? In other words, it's not that some wise person had to decide one day and have a dream or an epiphany and start using money, that it would just be a natural outgrowth of people first engaging in barter, and then money would emerge spontaneously. So we're going to just walk through that process.
Okay, so we're going to talk through money being a medium of exchange. Then we roll on into the free markets that, in my opinion, we haven't really had free markets since probably about Teddy Roosevelt.
The whole course is going to be studying the pure market economy. So you're right. We don't have that right now. But the strategy is, if somebody's going to go around saying, hey, we think the government's too intrusive and we ought to go to a smaller government and have a freer economy, in order to even talk like that responsibly, you have to know, well, what would that look like? In other words, what's this goal? What's the end state? So that's the function of this six-week class, is to just describe how the market economy works, and then sort of as a baseline, what would it look like without a bunch of government regulations and taxes? And so you can see that baseline and then contrast it with our current system and see that, the market economy would be more effective and more just, and most people would agree that, yeah, I'd rather live in a world like that than the one we have right now.
Bob, given the fact that we have, I would say now, as a government-based economy and a money-printing economy, what is the average person on the street? I mean, what's your advice to those people?
About what they should do in today's environment?
Yes.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it depends on the crowd. If it's a younger person, the advice I typically give is to say, first of all, realize that interest rates, even though they've been low for several years now, that's a very artificial outcome that the Fed is engineering, and that may soon slip out of their control. And so, it's possible interest rates are going to spike very quickly. So you definitely don't want to be walking around with lots of credit card debt and other sorts of debt that's variable interest rate, to try to get out of that as soon as you can. and more generally, just, I mean, it's this would be true in any environment, but particularly with what we've got right now, I tell younger people, just, you really need to save more, because that's just going to open up so many more opportunities and options that, depending on what happens, the more you've got saved up. And in particular, I say it's, when I say that, I don't just mean, oh, when you stop going to Starbucks and go to Dunkin' Donuts for your coffee. That's not what I mean. I mean, go get other sources of income. Don't just think, well, I got my job and I hope I don't lose it, and just twiddle your thumbs thinking that's all you can do. There's all sorts of things, especially with the internet right now, that younger people can figure out ways to, in their spare time, bring in more income. And I would encourage them to really develop those alternative methods, because you don't want to be brainstorming and trying to figure out how to generate income after you get laid off and unemployment's 15%. You want to get those wheels in motion earlier, before the next crisis occurs.
Bob, as a professional economist, when we look at the situation that we're in right now, I know the media are telling us that, you know, things are great, happy days are here again, but, you know, going back to my business days, I can read a balance sheet. The U.S. government has never been in worse shape than it is right now. The Fed has expanded the money supply at a breathtaking rate. They in 7 weeks, in the, when QE1 first got started, it took Bernanke 7 weeks to match the Fed's expansion of its balance sheet in its first 96 years. The employment situation is actually worse today than it was when the economy supposedly turned the corner and began its uptick. What do you see in front of us?
Well, I'm glad you keep shining a spotlight on some of those grim statistics. And it's unfortunately what's happened is, when Bernanke first started engaging in those unprecedented actions, lots of people were freaking out. I mean, I remember Glenn Beck on his show had a big diagram of the Fed's monetary base, and he had to use like a forklift to, you know, he had it blown up on a, like a poster board or something on the set of his show, and he had to use a forklift to lift himself up because the chart just shot up so quickly. But then, you know, after a few years of price inflation, according to the government's measures, and even at the grocery store and the gas pump, not really blowing up too much, people sort of just said, oh, I guess it's not true that dumping trillions of dollars into the banking sector is a bad idea. But really, that's just deferred the problem, and it's been festering. And so there's, I mean, that money is still sitting in the banking system. They still have, I think it's over $2 trillion in excess, what's called excess reserves at this point. So that's money that the commercial banks legally are allowed to lend out if they decided that would be more profitable for them than leaving it parked at the Fed. And so we're in this sort of unstable equilibrium, I would say, the last few years, where the banks are sitting on that money and everybody's holding their money and being afraid to spend it. And so that's allowed the Fed to get away with injecting all this money and buying up so-called toxic assets and lending money to the government at really low rates. But if that should unravel, and if prices should start rising, well, then that equilibrium is going to shatter really fast. And then the banks, instead of earning 25 basis points leaving it parked at the Fed, they're going to lend it out at 3-4%, what have you. And then once that starts in motion and that new money starts creating more money through our banking system, it's going to unravel very quickly. So I don't know when that's going to happen. I'm surprised it's lasted this long. But until they undo what they did back in starting in mid, late 2008, and they've been doing for years, there's still that vulnerability. That sword, if you will, is still hanging over the economy. And they're in a sort of catch-22, where the only way really to remove that threat is if the Fed undoes everything that it's been doing, and it starts selling off treasuries and selling off mortgage-backed securities to suck that money out of the system. But if they did that, that would crash the financial sector, and it would make the rates for borrowing for treasuries go way up. And so then all of a sudden the government would have to be spending hundreds of billions just to finance the debt. So they're really in an untenable position, and their sort of strategy is, well, let's just hope the economy magically recovers and then we'll just gradually unwind all this stuff. But the real issue is going to be, what if that doesn't happen? What if the economy is as bad as it is now, but then price inflation really starts taking off? They're going to have to decide, are we going to save the dollar, or are we just going to let that go? So it's a sort of bleak position we're in, and all I can really say is that households have to just prepare for the worst and make sure they don't get caught with interest rates spiking and the dollar crashing, that, you know, that their investments or their portfolio is not such that that wipes them out.
I, by virtue of this show, have gotten to where I can get some Fed guys on, particularly the former Fed guys on, and their strategy isn't so much to unwind the balance sheet as it is to hold these assets that they've bought until maturity. And when they say, well, that's our game plan, we're not going to go on the market and sell them because, you know, it would disrupt the market. We're just going to hold on to them until they mature. And then my next question is, well, where's the government going to get the money then? If it doesn't have the money now, where's it supposed to get the money to pay these debts when it matures? So, I mean, the fact of the matter is, this has been a permanent expansion in the Fed's balance sheet.
Right. I think you're making a good point there. So the majority of what they've bought over the last few years has been mortgage-backed securities, and what the Federal Reserve has bought is mortgage-backed securities and treasuries, which is just, you know, bonds issued by the federal government. And so with the mortgage-backed securities, yeah, the Fed could just say, well, we're not going to actually dump them on the market, but when they say we're just going to let them mature, still what that means is, as those things, is any individual security matures, you know, they get the payment, and then if they don't roll that over, because that's what they've been doing. It's not merely that they've been buying, what was it, 40, and then they rammed it down with a recent semi-taper. But that's the net addition they've been making monthly. That with previously, you know, when people would pay off the maturing mortgage-backed securities, they would take that money and go into the market and buy more. And so the point is, if they just merely refrain from doing that, if they stop rolling it over, then yeah, as it matures, that means the Fed's holdings will gradually diminish. And so that isn't still, that means the Fed then, instead of buying in the market and propping up the price, is going to stand back in the wings and let the, you know, the market start falling. So it's really just a matter of degree as to whether they're actually refraining from buying or actively selling. Either way, the Fed has been a major prop on mortgage-backed securities, and if they stop doing that, that's going to have an impact. And then you're also right, too, as far as treasuries, if the Fed stops buying all those treasuries, even if it doesn't dump them, well, then still that means the federal government now has to find people in the private sector or other governments who are willing to lend it that money. And those people know that they can't just dump it back on the Fed the way that's been happening the last few years. So that's going to make yields go up. And then it's just a vicious cycle where the government is in debt trouble, and then all of a sudden the interest rates to service that debt start rising. So that's just going to make things worse.
Bob, help me with one thing that has perplexed me. How does creating this money out of nothing and using it to buy treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, exactly how does that help the average American?
Well, of course it doesn't, but it's the theory is that they're saying, oh, well, the reason the economy's in the doldrums is that borrowing costs were too high and the people aren't spending enough, and so the theory was, oh, if we lower interest rates, that'll jumpstart spending. And in particular, the housing market's in trouble, and that's one of the channels through which normal economic operations is being stymied. And so, hey, if we buy mortgage-backed securities, that'll lower financing costs, that'll make it easier for people to get mortgages, so on and so forth. But you're right. In practice, that obviously hasn't been happening. It's just a clever way for the Federal Reserve to create, at this point, trillions of dollars and give it to politically connected insiders in the government. I mean, people have just run the numbers. It would have been cheaper if the Federal Reserve just created enough money to just buy all the underwater homes from Americans and, you quote unquote, solve the problem that way, you know, than what they've been doing in practice. So it's I don't think this was ever about Main Street. Just one last point on that. The whole, you know, they remember they sold all this stuff as this is what we need to do to resuscitate credit channels to make sure that lending to Main Street keeps occurring. But right in the fall of 2008, when they started down this path, that's also when the Fed started paying banks interest on reserves, on excess reserves. So what that meant is the Fed is literally paying commercial banks to not make loans to people. And so, you know, clearly this, none of this has been designed to make sure that banks lend money to into small businesses. They're literally being paid by the Fed to not make loans to small businesses.
Yeah, that was the caveat I failed to mention, and I'm glad you caught that. So they're creating money out of nothing buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, supposedly to stimulate the economy, and yet they're paying the banks on excess reserves that the banks got by way of this newly created money. So paying them not to lend the money out, this, in my opinion, this is just nothing but a ruse. It's just a way for the Fed to continue to bail out these banks and to transfer wealth from the average American to the financial elite. Am I being cynical?
Well, perhaps that's cynical, but it's certainly correct. So, yeah, that's exactly what's been happening. And it's, I mean, I think the function of Ben Bernanke these last few years has been, he's a, you know, a sharp academic with a lot of credentials. And so they told him, this is what we're going to do. Here's the policy. And then you go figure out a way to sell it to the public to make it look like this is economically sound. It's, I mean, it's a little bit sort of inside baseball, but it's kind of funny that the actions Bernanke has been taking and the way he justifies them at the Fed's press conferences and in his policy announcements doesn't line up with his own academic work. So it's, you know, clearly this, it's not like this is the natural outgrowth of the Ben Bernanke view of monetary policy. This is clearly, they knew what the policy was going to be. They were going to create a bunch of money and give it to political insiders, big bankers, and the government. And then Bernanke had to come up with some way to try to justify it when it doesn't really make sense when you analyze it.
Couldn't you say that he's been using a weak economy as political cover to transfer this wealth from us to them?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think the dynamic here, I've referred to Ben Bernanke as the FDR of central bankers. And what I mean by that is the same thing. You know, people remember during the 30s, there was the awful economy, and then Roosevelt came in and it was New Deal, and he fundamentally transformed Americans' conception of what the federal government's proper role in society was. And Bernanke's done the same thing. I mean, now we just sort of take it for granted that if there's some economic problem, people can be talking about it for just a few moments before someone says, oh, well, maybe the Fed can do such and such. I mean, that's new. That was not the case 10 years ago, that everyone just sort of automatically thought it was the Fed's job to come in like, oh, if California's bonds are in trouble, someone will say, well, maybe the Fed can just start buying California bonds. I mean, that would have been unthinkable even 10 years ago. But now, because the Fed has been looked at as the hero and the one to save the world economy, people just think that that's the case. So, yeah, I think there's numerous factors involved, but clearly the Fed, I mean, the Fed is a pseudo-private corporation that's owned by bankers. So we shouldn't be shocked that the Fed, when a crisis occurs and now has the opportunity to create trillions of dollars, is going to do that in a way that benefits bankers and is not going to do it in a way that benefits homeless people.
Yeah, never let a good crisis go to waste, in other words.
Yeah, exactly.
My daughter, 27-year-old girl, getting ready to graduate one more semester from Savannah College of Art and Design. I also went to Belmont up there, where you are, for a while. But she was telling me in engaging some of her friends and trying to explain to them that, you know, the Fed is basically a privately owned banking cartel owned by the banks. They looked at her like, oh, that's just a conspiracy theory. The government schools have done an excellent job of painting the Fed as some sort of benign, benevolent entity, haven't they?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I mean, same thing with what I just said about the New Deal. I mean, the way people, apologists or fans of Roosevelt, wouldn't deny that that happened. They would just say that's a good thing. But yeah, before the 1930s, Americans had this really outrageously unrealistic and sort of obsolete, antiquated notion of the federal government. And thank goodness Roosevelt got them to see all the goodies and all the benefits that a strong regulatory regime could confer upon them. And the same thing, too, with the Fed, that they would say, oh, yeah, before the Federal Reserve was formed, there was wildcat banking and the economy was all kind of really volatile and everyone was dependent on the whims of J.P. Morgan to come in and bail them out if there was a crisis. And thank goodness Americans joined the rest of the civilized world and got a central bank in 1913. But you're right. They don't stress the fact that it actually is a privately owned. I mean, there are shareholders in the Fed. So it's a highly regulated system. And, of course, it's not a normal entity because it's not like a truly private business because the federal government is involved in nominating and selecting the chairman and so forth. I mean, that's obviously not what happens at Walmart. But nonetheless, it is an odd creation, and it's certainly not a conspiracy theory to say it is controlled and owned by bankers, because it clearly is.
But don't you think the president selecting the next chairman from a list of names given to them by the banks, I mean, that's just all window dressing, isn't it? Just to make us think, those that are not in the know, just to make it appear that it's some sort of, hands-off type of entity?
Oh, right. I think I see what you're saying. Yeah, so it's funny that they try to have it both ways. I mean, one of the rationales or one of the alleged virtues of central banking is they want it to be independent. You know, like academic economists will talk about the importance of having an independent central bank for monetary stability and economic growth. And what they mean is that there's a bunch of academics sitting around setting monetary policy, and they're not being told what to do by the government. And so it is this tension in the Fed's official sort of image, where they, on the one hand, they want to make it look like they don't just print money because Washington asks them to, and sort of monetizing deficits. But on the other hand, they can't go too far the other way and make it look like, no, this is just truly an institution run by bankers, and there's no oversight by elected representatives. And so they do try to tread that fine line, and depending on the public's mood, they could stress one element or the other.
Do you think our media, the reason they gave everybody the financial elites a pass and during the financial crisis and even today, you don't hear hardly anybody on the mainstream discussing what's really going on with this monetary policy. It's, in effect, they've been bought off by TV advertising and credit lines and things like that.
Yeah, I think there's a combination of factors. I mean, part of it, I think, just is until something really obvious happens, like gasoline shoots up to $10 a gallon or something like that, they're just going to move on, because they're going to say, yeah, you guys were warning about currency debasement years ago and didn't seem like that happened. And so they're just going to move on to whatever the next story is. Also, there's just a lot of illiteracy financially and economically among the major media. They really just honestly don't know what they're talking about. And so, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that they're getting the story wrong. But beyond that, too, you're exactly right. They certainly know, whether it's conscious or subconscious, they always slant their stories in the angle of, if there's some social problem, what is the government with all of its power and wisdom and might going to do to fix it? Because we know that free people interacting in a market economy can't possibly solve problems. We need to have wise regulators come in and do something.
This is Bob Murphy, economist Bob Murphy, who's starting this Thursday, is going to be teaching a course called The Introduction to Free Markets. Before we run out of time, let's tease that one more time. Somebody, all they have to do to go to Mises, MISES.org, and sign up for this class, Bob?
Well, they could get it that way, but the quicker way is to go to academy.mises.org.
Academy.mises.org. Now, how does a online class actually work? I mean, is it going to be like a webinar or something? Are we going to get to see economist Bob Murphy?
That's right. Yeah, it'll give you a way to log in, and you'll see me. There's live lectures that I'll broadcast, and you'll see a little video. You know, you'll see my video stream and PowerPoint slides and stuff. But it's also recorded, so in case people can't make the live seminar, then they'll be able to get the recording of it and see the video that way. And there's also assigned readings and things like that if people want to do that as well.
And you said it's a 6-week course, but for example, week one, is it 1 hour per week, or I mean, how does that work?
Oh yeah, it's an hour and 15 minutes is the lecture length. It's
per week.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Bob, listen, it's been a pleasure. I have enjoyed your conversations that I've had with you in the past, and I always enjoy listening to you when you're doing Tom Woods. Are you set to do Tom Woods here pretty soon?
Yeah, I've been doing him every other week. We don't have the exact next appearance picked yet, but yeah, we're definitely trying to make that a regular thing. And thank you for having me, and I'm glad you're educating your listeners so much on economic and financial matters.
Well, hey, you and Mark Thornton, who's going to be joining me here in just a few minutes, y'all all help me do it. I'm just using your expertise. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
All right.